Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books on Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am your host today, Jinyi Lee from the University of Arizona. In today's episode, we have Dr. Olga Solovyova with us to talk about her new book, Japan's Russia, Challenging the East-West Paradigm, co-edited with Sho Konishi. It was published by Cambria Press earlier this year. Olga is currently an assistant professor at the University of Chicago, teaching and researching about comparative literature. In this volume, the authors examine the cultural negotiation between Japan and Russia in the late 19th and the 20th centuries, as well as its impact on today's Japan. Through discussions of Russia-related cultural and intellectual expressions and manifestations, such as literature, art, theology, and political thought, the authors challenge the dichotomies of the so-called East and West, pre-modernity and modernity. So welcome to our channel, Dr. Solovyova. It's a pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. And welcome, everybody.
Yes. So first of all, let me just say that this is such a wonderful book, very rich in its range of topics. I understand that your research is more about literature and theology. Is that correct? Can you tell us more about what you do?
Yeah, I'm trained actually as a Germanist and Russianist, and my specialty is comparative literature. And I came to this project through Russia, actually, and through my interest in the reception of Russian literature outside of Russia. And I came across the fact that Russian culture had tremendously interesting reception in Japan. And this project started as with my interest, long-term interest in Akira Kurosawa's Russian films, because I'm not only a literature scholar, I'm also a film scholar. And it's actually from the film studies that I came across Japan's Russia. And while studying Kurosawa, I was very puzzled by the fact that Kurosawa in the post-war period was interested in adapting the Russian sources, the Russian novels and dramas, Russian literature of the late 19th century with an explicitly populist democratic agenda, and that he was clearly using these Russian sources in his films, which were dealing with most sensitive taboo topics of the Japanese war crimes. This was very, very puzzling to me. Why does he do this specifically through the Russian literature of the 19th century. This was one puzzle of the Japan's Russia project. Another puzzle I came across in my interest of Russian reception abroad was when in 2009, basically by accident, at the wedding of my friend, or my Russian friend in California, I met her friend, as it happens at the weddings, who was a Japanese woman, Erika Haga, who came from the family of the founders of the Showa Women's University in Japan. And Showa Women's University was established by Hitomi Enkichi and his wife Midori in 1920s. And it still exists and prospers. And Erika's aunt, Noriko Hitomi, was chancellor of this university. And it was very strange. When Erika and I came into conversation, she just told me that she, and I told her that I'm Russian, she said, oh, I just came from the family reunion in Yasnaya Polyana. And I said, how come? And she said, oh, because my family is running this Showa Women's University, which was based on the Tolstoy's teachings. And I was extremely impressed by this, that Tolstoy's teachings resulted in Japan in an educational institution in the university. Because when I was growing up in the Soviet Union, we read, you know, in school mostly his big novels, War and Peace and Anna Karenina and early short stories. But Tolstoy's social teachings were never taught and never taken seriously. There was this attitude toward Tolstoy's, you know, social teaching that Tolstoy, you know, outlived himself, he became senile, it's not serious, it's utopian, and it's not something which, you know, one can possibly seriously engage with. And, you know, I, growing up in the Soviet Union, I registered this, and then I knew that there were Tolstoyan communities, communes all over the world and in America, but those were small kind of individual enterprises or initiatives. But I was very impressed that Tolstoy's teaching in Japan became a whole university. And I was so interested in this and so puzzled how Tolstoy's philosophy becomes an institution, so that I met with Erika's aunt, who was chancellor of the university, and they have a Boston campus too. I met with you on Boston campus and asked you to tell me the story, and I wanted to write an article about it, and I even went to Japan, to the Tokyo, and visited the campus and saw the university. I met with administration, and they told me the story that in 1920, Hitomi Enkichi, who was a famous poet and member of Shirakaba Society, was very dedicated to progressive agenda, educational agenda, specifically to the education of women and environmental studies and social policy. And he established this university on the basis of Tolstoy's late writings, which he implemented through this Tolstoy's pedagogical theories, Tolstoy's vision of the non-hierarchical society, of the care for nature, and so on. And during the period of militarism, they went underground and they were quiet about the Tolstoyan origins of the university. And they were quiet about it through the period of militarism and then through the period of the Cold War, because Tolstoy was basically first associated with the anarchist democratic thought, and was actually even banned in Japan in the 1930s. And then in a post-war, of course, everything Russian was associated with the Soviet Union. So they came out with their Tolstoy origins only in 1980s, and they created even a statue of Tolstoy into which they put all the foundational documents, the copies of the foundational documents of the university. So in the middle of their campus in Tokyo, you can see Tolstoy statue. And they have big family reunions every other year where the whole family or members of the family and administration of the university, which is still family run, meets in Yasnaya Polyana. So those were two amazing puzzle pieces which I had before, and I was trying to study this and come up with solutions and how, you know, why Japan has this interest in Russia, and specifically in this Russian democratic thought, and what it exactly means. And I noticed that it was something subversive, something which didn't agree with the official position of Japanese government on many issues, issues of culture, pedagogy, in the military spirit, or then in the post-war. And I was, you know, how in the post-war, how Japan was handling the recovery. And all these two pieces of puzzle came together when I came across Shokanishi's work on Russian-Japanese intellectual relations in modern Japan. Shō came to campus in 2007 to give a talk, and I got his paper on Tolstoy's on the reception of Tolstoy in Japan. And after I read this paper, I went and read more of his work, including his book on anarchist modernity. And this research, which Shō did, brought this strange, explained this strange phenomena to me, and brought the pieces of the puzzle together. Because in his book, he uncovered the association of the Russian culture from the opening of Japan to in the Meiji period with the strong sensibility of cultural, democratic, and political dissent. And he not only uncovered an amazing archive of the Russian-Japanese revolutionary encounters and intellectual encounters and exchanges, but also provided a brilliant analytical interpretation of this archival material, showing, first of all, how, you know, early in 1870s, many Russian revolutionaries who were banned in Russia to Siberia, to the where political prisoners were sent, showed how this contingency, this geopolitical contingency of Siberian prison camps on Sakhalin and nearby in Siberia resulted in a whole flow of the revolutionary escapees from those prisons who were running, managing to escape, and the closest place to escape to was Japan. And he also discovered that the major Russian anarchist and pre-Marxist revolutionary Lev Mechnikov came to Japan in the early 1870s, and established a school of Russian language where he was hiring those escapees from the Russian Siberian prisons, giving them temporary jobs. And some of them stayed there for several months, some of them stayed for several years, and then they were moving to America from Japan and from America back to Western Europe. What Shaw did, he discovered this, restored the whole global circulation of ideas of the revolutionary thought in which Japan was a very active participant. And this circulation of revolutionary democratic thought was happening through the mediation of Russian culture, through the non-official opening of Japan to Russia, to the revolutionary Russia. At the time where the official Japan, where the Japanese government was opening the country to the West, to the and with the West, to the Western, to the Western imperial project, whereas the Russian revolutionary project was critical of the empire, and it was actually guided by the unofficial networks among people. But what is interesting that from these encounters and from the school of the Russian language, where not only Russian language was taught, but also the major representatives of Russian populist democratic thought. They were learning, they were teaching language through texts. And through the Russian texts, Japanese who were learning Russian language were also acquiring or kind of learning this democratic ideals, which actually coincided with the populist uprisings underground in Japan during the Meiji revolution, or Meiji reforms. And this influx of the Russian revolutionary thought coincided with the people's freedom and rights movement, people's rights and freedom movement, and then very harmoniously merged. And when the people's rights and freedom movement was suppressed, it was channeled through the Russian translation culture into the intellectual production. And this intellectual production was signaling its subversive, democratic, oppositional attitude towards militarization, towards westernization often, which was understood kind of by the Japanese anarchists in imperial terms. The cultural production of this democratic dissent went into pedagogical theories, into environmental, the beginnings of the environmental studies, into peace movement, and to into many intellectual expressions of Japanese culture in 1920s and 30s. I think Shaw's book actually develops this transnational methodology of dealing with the intercultural encounters, not through the position of the, from the point of view of the state, from the point of view of the narratives, of the narratives of the winners of history, but from the point of view of the people from below, from the point of view of resistance. And Japan's Russia project, the book which we did together, which brings into dialogue the literature and history, grows out of this historical moment and out of this historical context of Japanese culture of Japanese populist descent. And this connects, of course, to the Hitomi and Kichi's foundation of the Showa Women's University, yeah, because it was exactly this moment where the Russia represented this democratic thought and democratic pedagogical thought, and he channeled it into the institution, and he was able to channel the institution. Why Japanese were able to channel these ideas into institutions? Because Japan has a strong culture of mutual aid, of communal organization, which actually Russia has was missing. Yeah, and because Japanese peasants, as Mechnikov observed when he traveled through Japan, were able of tremendous communal organization, which they call Sogo Fujo, where they were helping each other out when the feudal lords failed help out their peasants. They had to rely on themselves. So, in a way, Mechnikov was very fascinated by this, because he saw that anarchist thought of self-organization, which was, you know, missing in Russia, could be learned from Japan, and he learned a lot, and he brought this idea of Sogo Fujo to Europe and shared this with Kropotkin. So, but the Hitomi and Kichi, to return to Hinkomi Tichi, Showa Women's University, it's one of those cultural expression of that democratic underground culture. And it was really confirmed by the story of the family, how they were concealing their Tolstoy affiliation. And Kurosawa, I show, it became very clear to me that Kurosawa, the Japanese director, stands in this democratic tradition of the populist anarchist descent and brings it into the post-war, recovers it, as there were many other attempts at recovery of this culture in the post-war. He represents one of them. So, and the idea of confronting the Japanese war crimes and the problems of reconstruction through the 19th century populist Russian literature, which was associated in Japan in the 19th century with the democratic descent, basically harks back to this heritage, which he tries to, among other people, to restore in a post-war as an alternative between American westernization on the one side and the Soviet Union on the other. Yeah, this becomes a democratic alternative between two different types of ideological powers which are confronted in the Cold War. So our book basically deals with many cultural expressions beginning from the First World War and into the 21st century of this intellectual tradition of the democratic populist descent. in different ways and in forms, and give some counterparts to it too.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, that's very astonishing. Yeah, there's so much that you just mentioned that I would very much like to unpack. So you mentioned that in the book as well, that Japan's this cultural and intellectual negotiation with Russia is seldom discussed in scholarships on Russia or Japan. And in my personal knowledge, when we talk about after the Meiji Restoration, when Japan was learning from the quote-unquote Western countries, we often emphasize the role of Germany in terms of, say, literature and culture. And while we talk about Russia, maybe Russia's impact on Japan, it's usually about the military system, the political system. So gathering from what you just said, would you say that the reasons that such discussion on Russian influences on Japan's cultural and intellectual production was absent, mostly, what were the reasons, mostly political?
Why the it's absent from the scholarship?
Well, yes.
It's absent mostly from the American scholarship. Actually, it is, I think, very well explored in Japan, because Japan has very strong Russian studies and has tremendous amount of very good specialists on Russia. It is absent from Russian scholarship for another reason, because it is, you know, during the Soviet period, basically under Stalin, the Japanology was wiped out in the Soviet Union. All Japanologists was executed or spent, you know, very significant prison terms, because everybody who knew Japanese was accused of being Japanese spies. And the recovery of Japanese studies in Russia started only when Kawabata received his Nobel Prize in the mid-60s. And basically, Russians who had very strong Japanology in the pre-Soviet times had to start from scratch. In America, it is absent because naturally, Americans are interested in the American presence in Japan, and mostly focused on exploring Japanese-American relations, as it usually done in most countries. Yeah, people interested how their culture relates to another culture, and this is what makes this book unique, really, in the English language context. It's introduced the third entity, the third point of view, but within the American, within the American scholarship, yeah, or let us say English language scholarship. And reasons for political, for different, also because of the Cold War, of course, yeah, because there were clearly a competition between America and the Soviet Union over Japan and who was more influential, and they both countries were trying to win Japan over. And you're right, the Cold War also influenced the fact that people oversaw Russian presence in Japan, but also because, you know, to do this in America, you need to know Japanese and Russian, yeah, two very difficult languages. And it is, in many ways, has been the obstacle to uncovery of this relationship. And Shokanishi was uniquely positioned because, of course, he's Japanese and he knows Russian very well. And he was able to do all the initial archival research, yeah, and show these connections. And he happened to be educated in America. So he had this all three perspectives coming together, which is a unique situation and a great contingency. But our volume already builds upon his initial field work and his initial uncovery of certain cultural patterns. And people who contributed to our volume are already, you know, young scholars or scholars from the adjacent fields, most of whom know Japanese, and not all of whom knew also Russian. Yeah, because actually after reading Shaw's book, you already can easily see the presence of Russia in much of the Japanese cultural production without knowing Russian. You don't need Russian for this anymore, yeah? Because he did all the initial discoveries. You can discover one additional document here or there, but the pattern which he showed is there, and you can very easily see it, and also you can use, you know, the method, and we deal with Japan's Russia not so much as a theme or as the method of reading cultural production across border and from the margins.
Indeed, and I definitely think this book, this volume, is a great example of interdisciplinary and transnational studies, as it covers not just literature or film, it's also art and theology. And before reading your book, I had not seen any book that dealt with these issues. So from reading the book, I get the impression that you and the other authors are really challenging this binary of East, the East versus the West. And it's an important theme throughout this book that is the dichotomies of pre-modernity and modernity, uncivilized and civilized nature and technology or civilization. I was hoping you could elaborate more on how this book challenges these dichotomies.
Well, in the first chapter, we have a brilliant piece by Andrew Wei Leung, which challenges the idea of the influence, yeah, because basically the East-West paradigm usually associated with the idea of influence, and this influence is usually interpreted as channeling of knowledge, channeling of ideas from the West to the East, yeah, and East is a kind of a passive recipient of the West. It's usually binary, it's usually static, it's usually one-way street. What we are showing actually that this whole circularity, yeah, circularity of ideas, how the ideas move both ways, how people are coming from, you know, Russia and from Japan by their own initiative encounter might pursue very similar interests. Yeah, might their interests were interested in what happens when intellectual from different parts of the world meet and exchange their ideas and pursue certain projects. Yeah, and because this is what Shosh wrote in his book, Mechnikov arrived in Japan. He learned Japanese for 2 years and Chinese before arriving there. But, you know, it was terra incognita. He basically didn't know what will happen. And what happened, he traveled and he saw, Japanese peasants or farmers, amazing organizational skills which were missing in Russia. And he developed his theory of the, he revised his theory of Western civilization, of the advanced of a civilization. On the basis of this observation, he turned revolution into evolution. Yeah. So we're similarly interested. So when two intellectuals meet from different parts of the world, what happens? How they learn from each other? What happens? How the ideas are received across border? How they circulate? Yeah, and because it's never just two entities, this is much more. So basically, this book is written by all of us collectively against the idea of influence. This is our major goal. Or for example, we have a piece on Pilsudski, yeah, Bronislav Pilsudski, and Uyaba Genchiro. They are both anthropologists who are both interested in Ainu. And it is interesting how Pilsudski, who was the Polish citizen of of Polish ethnicity, but Russian citizen, yeah, how he understood Ainu and their position at the margins of the Japanese Empire. And the margins of the Russian Empire, through his own experience of somebody who grew up at the margins, at the Western margins of the Russian Empire, yeah, ethnicity which was basically deprived of political rights, and how his whole personal experience of this exclusion motivated him to come up with the solution of the position within Russia and Japan. And then he encounters somebody on the Japanese side who is interested in similar questions, but for different reasons, and what happens in the exchange, yeah, and what how they imagine this Ainu self-determination. Another thing I need to mention that Japan's Russia is a non-monolithic concept, yeah, because when we usually talk about East-West, we have a very clear kind of simplistic vision. What is East? What is West? We reduce it to certain kind of ideological matrix, yeah, or philosophical matrix. And what we show in this volume, that both Japan and Russia are actually not a monolithic. We show how diverse is Japanese culture, how diverse is Russian culture, even ethnically. Yeah, Japan, we talk about Ainu, we talk about Japanese Muslims, we talk about Japanese orthodoxy. We talk about, Manchuria and many margins of the Japanese Empire throughout its history. And the same as Russians. Yeah, Russia represented also by Muslims, also by the, Polish, by Belarusians. And we show how people within these diverse spaces and from this diverse people meet and they come bring their diversity into dialogue. Yeah, it is not just two entities. It is really these encounters. They are very multidimensional, politically, ethnically, ideologically, And basically, they can be reduced to the matrix of East and West, yeah? Or to ethnic matrix of Japan and Russia, yeah?
Well, thank you. That was quite amazing. And I'm really glad that these chapters are pointing out this issue that Japan was not as simple, if it's a good way to put it, as a lot of people might imagine. And to kind of connect to what you were saying, I noticed that in the first page of this book that's entitled Japan's Russia, there is a quote from Lu Xun, which I found quite curious. It's actually one of my favorite quotes from Lu Xun.
Yeah.
Yes. So while this book seemingly deals with Japan, Russia, the cultural encounters, as you were mentioning earlier, were not limited to Japanese and Russian culture, what else was there in the cross-border exchanges, and how did it happen?
Well, we of course deal also with China. Yeah, we show how Ito Ken traveled to Shanghai and collaborated with progressive Chinese intellectuals of his time there. We show also the Manchuria. Manchurian old believers who came to Manchuria as escapees from Russia and met there, basically ended up in the Manchukuo state under Japanese governance, and but came into interesting relations with the Japanese ethnographers and with the Japanese photographer Yamazoe Saburo, and so on. Yeah, we show how Kamanaka Hitomi, who made the film about Fukushima, traveled to Belarus to share the nuclear experience and how to deal with this in Belarus. So the quote from Lu Xun is also, I love this quote because I think it fitted very well the agenda or the goal of our book to develop the new methodology. Yeah, methodology which deals with complexity, with personal encounters and collaborations and creation of knowledge from the margins. We challenge the grand, official state-sponsored narratives of the Japanese and Russian history. And I think we also got a lot of younger people who did very new research, very original research, and tried to challenge these paradigms in their own right. And I think it's a beautiful quotation because it's kind of invest the book with hope that the new generation of scholars will open, by doing new scholarship, will open the new roads where we will be looking at the collaborations, cross-cultural collaborations, not in terms of the bigger, preconceived ideas of ideological ideas, of what is East and what is West, and who influences whom and who is more important, but through looking at the very concrete culture production on concrete people and see what happens there, how it intersects or challenges the other narratives, the academic narratives, the political narratives, and draw conclusion from this more open-minded, kind of pragmatic approach to subject matter. Yeah, when we always ask the question, what happens between these two people within this context and how it relates to what we know?
Um, So that's yes, that's I was going to ask you about this. To how would you situate your project in a wider context for studies to challenge this cliche of the East versus West or pre-modern versus modernity issue? And I definitely think that what you just said to constantly challenge ourselves to come up with new researches and to collaborate with scholars outside of our field, those are very important tasks for academics to do in order to broaden the horizon of not just our own fields, but also the wider field, like not in just a regional sense, but also in a disciplinary sense.
Yeah. Today, you know, it is the emergent, this book fits the emergent field of circulatory histories, which look at the history from the you know, from the local cultural production rather than from the top-down kind of ideological narratives. So, and one more thing I can add to it, that looking at such transcultural encounters requires another historical dimension. If you think that Russian democratic thought of late 19th century, which was extremely rich and extremely important all over the world, was totally eradicated after the October Revolution in Russia. When the Bolsheviks came to power, what we had was the dictatorship of the proletariat. So any activism from below, any democratic expression of the people was not possible anymore. And that's why Tolstoy's social writings, which are anarchist, which are all about the individual activism and individual grassroots organization, this all was completely eradicated in a very, very brutal way. However, through the Russian-Japanese translation culture, it escaped into Japan. As the escapees, as the people were escaping from the Siberian prisons, then the ideas escaped through the translation culture. They were cross-fertilized with Japanese culture, with Japanese descent, and they sedimented themselves in whole layer of democratic cultural production in Japan. And I see this book now and this kind of task of uncovery of this Russian democratic heritage as another important goal of this volume. Because now when Russia overcame this heritage of the Soviet dictatorship, and now it moved into another type of dictatorship, of the basically proto-fascist dictatorship and nationalist dictatorship. So we again don't have the space for this democratic thought, and Russians at the moment are struggling to recreate, to restore the democratic heritage. And ironically, we have to go abroad to look for this thought. And Japan is one of those places where we can go and look at this production of Japanese democratic descent, which was cross-fertilized with Russian democratic thought. And we can win it back. We can distill it out of this metamorphosis, or we can get it back in rich form, enriched through the Japanese experience. There's a way, different ways to proceed. But for me, it is a treasure. Yeah, it is kind of a historical treasure where the culture which was oppressed and repressed and suppressed escaped. And I think it applies for many other cultures. Yeah, that we can look at this intercultural relations as a way of doing the history of Russia. And ironically, this history of Russia now is most plausibly, or the history of Russian democratic thought could be most plausibly done through uncovering this cultural layer of the Japanese culture.
I absolutely agree. That is indeed fascinating. I guess to end our conversation today, I was hoping you could read this quote of Lu Xun to us in a way, as a way to inspire young scholars out there, or young graduate students and even undergraduate students out there, to discover new realms in their studies.
Yeah, actually, we included several postdocs, we included graduate students who did their original new work on the basis of new material uncovered in Japanese archives. I even included my undergraduate student who took a class with me on Russian Kurosawa. She co-wrote with me a piece. So we were very dedicated to the idea of including new generation scholars into this project. And this is for whom, actually, to whom this epigraph is addressed. So I will read it. Hope is something that you can't say exists or doesn't exist. It's like roads on the earth. Originally, there weren't any roads across the earth. But when enough people walked them, the roads appeared. This is for Lu Xun, My Old Home, 1921.
Thank you. That is beautiful. I truly appreciate your time today, Olga, for having this conversation with us. It was a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, our listeners, for joining us. That was Dr. Olga Solovyova in her new book, Japan's Russia, Challenging the East-West Paradigm. Stay tuned, and I will see you in our next episode. Goodbye.